Act 2. Prologue. The first time I leave the facility in 10 years, the sun is a blinding white orb in a gray dishwater sky. I have forgotten how enormous the outside world is. At first, I'm paralyzed by the vastness of it, like someone's pet goldfish dropped unexpectedly into the ocean. Then I see Philippa, leaning on the side of her car, the light glinting off her aviators. I barely resist the urge to run at her. We embrace roughly, like brothers, but I hold her longer than that. She's solid and familiar, and it's the first affectionate human contact I've had in far too long. I bury my face in her hair. It smells like almonds, and I inhale as deeply as I can, press my hands flat against her back so I can feel her heartbeat. Oliver. She sighs and squeezes the back of my neck. For one wild moment, I think I'm going to burst into tears, but when I let go of her, she's smiling. She doesn't look any different. Of course, she's been back to see me every 2 weeks since they put me away. Besides Colborne, she's the only one who has. Thank you, I say. For what? For being here. Today. My poor prisoner, she says, laying one hand on my cheek. I am as innocent as you. Her smile fades and she withdraws her hand. Are you sure you want to do this? For a second or two, I really do think about it. But that's all I've done since Colborne's last visit, and I've made up my mind. Yeah, I'm sure. All right. She pulls the driver's door open. Get in. I climb into the passenger seat, where a pair of men's jeans and a t-shirt are neatly folded. I move them into my lap as she starts the car. These Milos? He won't mind. I didn't think you'd want to show up wearing the same clothes you left in. These aren't the same clothes. You know what I mean, she says. They don't fit. You look like you've gained about 20 pounds. Don't most people lose weight in prison? Not if they want to get out in one piece, I tell her. Besides, there's not much to do. So you exercise incessantly? You sound like Meredith. Afraid I'm going red, I pull my shirt off, hoping she won't notice. Her eyes seem to be on the road, but her glasses are mirrored, so I can't really tell. How is she? I ask, as I look for the tag in the other shirt. Certainly not struggling. We don't talk much. None of us do anymore. What about Alexander? Still in New York, she says, which isn't the answer to the question I'm asking. Took up with some company that does really intense immersive stuff. Right now he's playing Cleopatra in a warehouse filled with sand and live snakes. Very Artaud. They're doing The Tempest next, but it might be his last show.
Why?
Well, they want to do Caesar, and he refuses to be in that ever again. He thinks that's the play that fucked us all up. I keep telling him he's wrong.
You think it was Macbeth that fucked us up?
No. She stops at a red light and glances at me. I think we were all fucked up from the start.
The car rumbles to life again, slides into first gear, then second.
I don't know if that's true, I say, but neither of us pursues the subject.
We drive in silence for a while, and then Philippa turns the stereo on. She's listening to an audiobook. Iris Murdoch, The Sea, The Sea. I read it in my cell a few years ago. Apart from exercising and hoping to go unnoticed, that's what a fledgling Shakespeare scholar does in prison. By the midpoint of my 10-year tenure, I'd been rewarded for my good, i.e. unobtrusive behavior, with a job shelving books instead of peeling potatoes. Because I know the story, I barely listen to the words. I ask Philippa if I can roll the window down, and I hang my head out like a dog. She laughs at me but says nothing. The fresh Illinois air skips across my face, weightless and flighty. I look out at the world through my eyelashes, alarmed by how bright it is even on this overcast day. My mind wanders down the road to Delacour, and I wonder, will I recognize it? Maybe they've torn the castle down, raised the trees to make room for real dormitories, and put up a fence to keep kids out of the lake. Maybe now it looks like a children's summer camp, sterile and safe. Or maybe it, like Philippa, has hardly changed at all. I can still see it, lush and green and wild, in some tiny way enchanted, like Oberon's Wood or Prospero's Island. There are things they don't tell you about such magical places, that they're as dangerous as they are beautiful. Why should Delacour be any different? 2 hours go by, and then the car is parked in the long, empty drive at the hall. Philippa gets out first, and I follow, slowly. The hall itself is the same, but I look immediately beyond it to the lake, resplendent under the bloodless sun. The surrounding forest is as thick and savage as I remember, the trees stabbing fiercely up at the sky. "You all right?" Philippa asks. I haven't moved from the side of the car. "This is as strange a maze as e'er men trod." Panic flutters softly around my heart. For a moment I'm 22 again, watching my innocence slip through my fingers with equal parts eagerness and terror. 10 years of trying to explain Delacour in all its misguided magnificence to men in beige jumpsuits who never went to college or never even finished high school has made me realize what I, as a student, was willfully blind to, that Delacour was less an academic institution than a cult. When we first walked through those doors, we did so without knowing that we were now part of some strange, fanatic religion where anything could be excused so long as it was offered at the altar of the Muses. Ritual madness. Ecstasy. Human sacrifice. Were we bewitched? Brainwashed? Perhaps. "Oliver," Philippa says more gently, "are you ready?" I don't answer. I never was. "Come on." I trail behind her as she walks. I've braced myself for the shock of seeing Delacour again, unchanged or otherwise, but what I'm not expecting is the sudden ache in my chest, like longing for an old lover. I've missed it, desperately. "Where is he?" I ask when I catch up with Philippa. "He wanted to wait at the Boar's Head, but I wasn't sure you should go back yet."
"Why not?"
"Half the same people still work there." She shrugs. "I didn't know if you'd be ready to see them."
"I'd be more concerned that they're not ready to see me," I say, because I know that's what she's really thinking.
"Yeah," she says. "That too." She leads me through the front doors, the Delacour coat of arms, key and quill, staring disapprovingly down at me as if to say, "You are no longer welcome here." I haven't asked Philippa who else knows I'm coming back. It's summer and the students are gone, but the staff often linger. Will I turn a corner and find myself face to face with Frederick? Gwendolyn? God forbid, Dean Holinshed. The hall is eerily empty. Our footsteps echo in the wide corridors, usually so tightly packed with people that any small sound is trampled underfoot. I peer curiously into the music hall. Long white sheets hang over the windows, and the light falls in wide, pale stripes across the vacant seats. It has the haunted feeling of an abandoned cathedral. The refectory, too, is empty. Almost. Sitting alone at one of the student tables, nursing a cup of coffee and looking distinctly out of place, is Colborne. He stands hastily and offers one hand. I grasp it without hesitation, strangely glad to see him. "Me, Chief?" "Colborne."
"Not anymore. Turned in my badge last week."
"Philippa." "Why the change of heart?" "Colborne."
"Mostly my wife's idea. She says if I'm going to risk getting shot on a regular basis,
I ought to at least be paid well for it.
Philippa. How touching.
Colborn. You'd like her.
Philippa laughs and says, Probably.
And how are you? He asks. Still hanging around this place?
He glances down at the empty tables, up at the corniced ceiling, as though he's not quite sure where he is. Well, we live in Broadwater, she says. We, I assume, refers to her and Milo. I didn't know they'd moved in together. She is almost as much a mystery to me now as she was 10 years ago, but I don't love her any less for it. I know more than most about desperately kept secrets.
We don't come out here much during the summer.
Colborn nods. I wonder if he feels at all awkward around her. He knows me. He knew all of us once. But now? Does he look at her and see a suspect? I watch him closely and hope I won't have to remind him of our bargain.
Can't be much reason to, he says amiably enough.
We've got to decide on a season for next year, but we can do that in town.
Any ideas yet?
We're thinking about Twelfth Night for the 3rd years. We have 2 that actually share some DNA for the first time since Ren and Richard.
There's a brief, uncomfortable pause before she continues.
And we really have no idea what to do with the 4th years. Frederick wants to branch out and try Winter's Tale, but Gwendolyn's insisting on Othello.
Good group this year?
Good as ever. We picked more girls than boys for once.
Well, that can't be a bad thing.
They share a fast grin, and then Philippa looks pointedly at me. She raises her eyebrows just barely.
Now or never.
I turn to Colborn, mimic her expression. He checks his watch.
Shall we take a walk?
Whatever you want, I tell him.
All right, he says to me.
And then to Philippa,
Coming?
She shakes her head, somehow frowning and smiling at the same time.
I don't need to, she says. I was there.
Colborn's eyes narrow. Unperturbed, she touches my arm, says,
I'll see you tonight,
and walks out of the refectory. Colborn's unasked questions hanging in the air behind her. He watches her leave, then asks,
How much does she know?
She knows everything.
He frowns, eyes nearly disappearing beneath his thick brows.
People always forget about Philippa, I add, and later they always wish they hadn't.
He sighs, like he doesn't have the energy to be really disgruntled. He contemplates his coffee for a moment, then abandons it on the table.
Well, he says, lead the way.
Where?
You'd know better than I would.
I'm silent, thinking. Then I sit. It's as good a place as any.
Colborn chuckles reluctantly.
You want some coffee?
I wouldn't say no.
He disappears into the kitchen where 2 coffee urns stand in the corner. They've been there at least 14 years. They're always full, though I never, even as a student, saw who filled them. He comes back with a full mug, sets it in front of me. I watch the milk swirl as he sits down in the same chair he just got up from.
Where do you want me to start? I ask.
He shrugs.
Wherever you think is best. See, Oliver, I don't just want to know what happened. I want to know the how and the why and the when. I want to make sense of it.
For the first time in a long time, that little rip in the middle of me, the black bruise on my soul that's been struggling to heal for nearly a decade, throbs. Old feelings come softly thronging back. Bittersweetness, discord, and confusion.
I wouldn't count on that, I tell Colborn. It's been 10 years and I still can't make sense of it.
And maybe this will be good for both of us.
Maybe.
I sip my coffee pensively.
It's good. It has flavor, unlike the brownish slime we drank in prison, which on good days only vaguely reminded me of coffee. The heat soothes the swelling pain in my chest for a moment. So, I say when I'm ready. The mug warms my palms, and the memories flood through me like a drug, razor-sharp, crystal-clear, kaleidoscopic. Fall semester 1997. I don't know if you remember, but it was a warm autumn that year. Scene 1. 2 weeks before opening night, we had our photos taken for publicity, and the fab was an absolute madhouse. In order to take photos, we needed costumes, and everyone was running back and forth from the dressing rooms to the rehearsal hall, changing ties and shirts and shoes until Gwendolyn was satisfied. The previous year's election had inspired Frederick to do Caesar as a presidential race, so we were all dressed as White House hopefuls. I had never worn a suit that really fit me in my life, and my own reflection surprised me more than once. For the first time, I entertained the idea that I could be handsome, with enough effort. Previously, I'd thought of myself as attractive only in a forgettable, inoffensive way, an idea reinforced by the fact that the few girls I'd been mixed up with inevitably seemed to realize that they liked me better on stage as Antonio or Demetrius than offstage as my mild-mannered self. Of course, among my classmates, I might as well have been invisible. Alexander looked like a mafioso in shimmering charcoal gray, an onyx tie pin glinting on his chest. James, immaculate in deep ink blue, could have been the heir apparent of some small European monarchy. But Richard, in pale pearl gray and a blood-red tie, cut the most impressive figure of us all. "Is it just me, or does that suit actually make him taller?" I asked, looking through the door of the rehearsal hall where they'd set up a black screen to be our backdrop. They wanted Richard first for the campaign poster shot, as Gwendolyn kept calling it. "I think his ego just makes him look bigger," James said. Alexander craned his neck to see between us. "Maybe so, but you can't deny the guy looks good." He glanced at me and added, "So would you if you could learn to tie a Windsor knot properly." Me. "Is it still crooked?" Alexander. "Have you seen yourself?" Me. "Just fix it, will you?" Alexander tipped my chin up to adjust my tie and carried on whispering to James. "Honestly, I'm glad we've got a night off from rehearsal for this. Every time we do the fucking tent scene with Gwendolyn's commentary, I just want to lie down and die." "Arguably, that's sort of how you should feel." "Look, I expect to be emotionally exhausted after a show, but she makes that scene so real that I look at you offstage and I can't decide if I want to kiss you or kill you." I snorted out a laugh, and Alexander jerked on my tie. "Stop squirming." "Sorry." Philippa appeared behind us from the girls' dressing room. She had at least three costumes. At that particular moment, it was a pinstriped pantsuit. Not flattering.
"What are we talking about?"
she whispered. Alexander. "I might make out with James tomorrow." James.
"Lucky me."
Philippa.
"Could be worse. Remember Midsummer, when Oliver headbutted me in the face?"
Me.
"In my defense, I tried to kiss you nicely, but I couldn't see because Puck squirted his love juice right in my eye."
Alexander. "There was so much innuendo in that sentence, I don't even know where to start." Across the room, Gwendolyn clapped her hands and said,
"Well, I don't think we're going to get anything better than that. What's next? The couples? Fine." She turned toward us and called, "Philippa, go and find the other girls, won't you?"
"Because they couldn't possibly want me here for any other reason," Philippa muttered, and disappeared into the dressing room again.
"Honestly," James said, shaking his head, "if they don't give her a decent role in the spring, I'm boycotting the show."
When the other girls appeared, it was immediately clear that wardrobe had spent more time on them. Wren was in a tasteful navy dress, while Meredith wore something red that hugged her curves like a coat of paint, her hair blown out to its full volume like a lion's mane.
"Where do they want us?"
Meredith asked. "In the centerfold, I'd imagine," Alexander said, looking her up and down. "Did they have to pour you into that?"
"Yeah," she said, "and I'll need 5 people to pry me out of it."
She seemed annoyed about it more than smug. "Well," James said, "I'm sure there will be no shortage of volunteers." He didn't make it sound like something to be smug about.
"James,"
Gwendolyn barked,
"I need you and the girls over here yesterday."
They made their way across the room, Meredith carefully tiptoeing between the tangled extension cords and gleaming patent pumps.
"So," Philippa said, "I don't even count as a girl now."
"No offense," Alexander said, "but not in that outfit you don't."
"Quiet in the hall, please,"
Gwendolyn called, without even turning around. Philippa made a face like she'd just bitten into a rotten apple.
"God, spare me,"
she said.
"I'm going for a smoke."
She didn't elaborate, but she didn't need to. As Gwendolyn and the photographer arranged Richard, Meredith, James, and Wren under the lights, it was impossible to ignore the blatant display of favoritism. I sighed, barely bothered, and watched James, hardly aware of the camera, unintentionally charming, as Gwendolyn jostled him and Wren together. I was only half listening when Alexander leaned close to my ear and said, "Are you seeing what I'm seeing?"
"Huh?"
"Okay, actually pay attention for a minute, and then tell me if you see it." At first I had no idea what he was talking about, but then I did see something. Just a twitch at the corner of Meredith's mouth as Richard's hand brushed her back. They stood side by side, turned slightly toward each other, but Meredith didn't quite look like Calpurnia, the perfect politician's wife, adoring to the point of distraction. Her hand lay flat on Richard's lapel, but it looked stiff and unnatural there. At the photographer's instruction, he put one arm around her waist. She lifted her own arm just barely so their elbows weren't touching.
"Trouble in paradise?" Alexander suggested.
After the Halloween incident, as I kept thinking of it, we had all proceeded largely as though nothing out of the ordinary had happened, dismissing it as a bit of drunken horseplay gone too far. Richard offered James a perfunctory apology, which was accepted with proportionate insincerity, and from that point forward they were rigidly cordial to each other. The rest of us were making a commendable, if doomed, effort to get back to normal. Meredith was the unexpected exception. For the first few days of November, she refused to speak to Richard at all.
"Aren't they sleeping in the same room again?" I asked.
"Not as of last night."
"How do you know?"
He shrugged.
"The girls tell me things."
I looked sideways at him.
"Anything interesting?"
He gave me a quick once-over and said,
"Oh, you have no idea."
I could tell he wanted me to ask what, so I didn't. I peeked back through the door, hoping to reach a conclusion on the state of affairs with Meredith, but another small movement distracted me. At Gwendolyn's instruction, Wren tilted her head to rest on James's shoulder.
"Don't they look like the perfect American couple?" Alexander remarked.
"Yeah." The camera flashed. James played idly with a strand of Wren's hair, but at the nape of her neck, where I was fairly sure the photographer wouldn't catch it. I frowned, squinted across the room.
"Alexander, are you seeing what I'm seeing?"
He followed my gaze with only a vague show of curiosity. James continued winding one lock of Wren's hair around his finger. I couldn't tell if either of them even realized he was doing it. Wren smiled, maybe for the camera, as if she had a secret. Alexander gave me a queer, sad sort of look.
"Are you just seeing this now?" he said. "Oh, Oliver,
You're as oblivious as they are.
Scene 2. The following night's dress rehearsal was our first on a finished set. 12 grand Tuscan columns made a half circle on the top platform, and a flight of shallow white steps led down into what we called the bowl, a flat faux marble disc on the floor, 8 feet in diameter, where the infamous assassination took place. Behind the columns, the scrim glowed softly, cycling through a full spectrum of celestial colors, from dusky twilight purple to the orange blush of sunrise. A new set always presented challenges we hadn't anticipated during early rehearsals, and we all returned to the castle short-tempered and sore. James and I immediately went up to the tower. "Is it just me, or did that run somehow take about 10 hours? I asked, falling backward onto my bed. The mattress caught me, and I groaned. It was after midnight, and we'd been on our feet since 5.
"Feels like it."
James sat on the edge of his bed and ran his hands through his hair. When he lifted his head again, he looked tousled and tired, even a little bit ill. There wasn't enough color in his face. I propped myself up on my elbows. "You okay?"
"Why?"
"You seem really, I don't know, worn out."
"I haven't been sleeping well."
"Something bothering you?" He blinked at me as if he hadn't understood the question, then said,
"No, it's nothing."
He stood and pulled his shoes off.
"Are you sure?"
He turned his back to me as he unbuttoned his jeans and let them slide to the floor.
"I'm fine."
His voice sounded flat, wrong, as if someone had struck a false note on the piano. I pushed myself off the bed and crossed slowly to his side of the room.
"James," I said, "don't take this the wrong way, but I kind of don't believe you."
He glanced over his shoulder at me.
"I never in my life did hear a challenge urged more modestly."
"You know me too well." He folded his jeans and dropped them on the foot of his bed.
"So tell me what's wrong."
He hesitated.
"You have to promise me you're going to keep it to yourself."
"Yeah, of course."
"You won't want to," he warned.
"James," I said more urgently, "what are you talking about?" He didn't answer. He just pulled his shirt off and stood there in his underwear without speaking. I stared at him, bewildered and inexplicably anxious. A dozen different questions tangled together in my mouth before my own awkwardness made me glance down and I realized what he was trying to show me.
"Oh my God!"
I seized both his wrists and pulled him toward me, the abashment of the previous moment forgotten. Bruises in raw, vivid blue spotted the undersides of his arms, all the way to his elbows.
"James, what is this?"
"Finger marks." I let go of his left arm like I'd been electrocuted.
"What?"
"The assassination scene," he said. "When I stab him the last time, he goes down on his knees and grabs my arms and... well..."
"Has he seen this?"
"Of course not."
"You have to show him," I said. "He might not even know he's hurting you."
He looked up at me with a flash of annoyance.
"When was the last time you left a mark like this on someone and didn't know you were doing it?"
"I've never left a mark like that on anyone, ever."
"Exactly. You'd know if you had."
I realized I was still holding his other wrist and abruptly let go. He rocked backward, unbalanced, as if I'd been pulling him forward before. He brushed his fingers along the inside of his arm, biting hard on his bottom lip like he was afraid to open his mouth, afraid of what might come out. Suddenly, I was furious, my pulse throbbing softly in my ears. I wanted to give Richard 10 bruises for every one he'd put on James, but I could never hope to hurt him. Not like that. And my own inefficacy made me angrier than anything else.
"You have to tell Frederick and Gwendolyn that he's doing this," I said, more loudly than I meant to.
"Like a snitch?" James said.
No, thank you.
Just Frederick, then.
No.
You have to say something.
He pushed me back a step.
No, Oliver.
He glanced away into some empty corner of the room.
You promised me you wouldn't say a word, so don't.
I felt a little prick of pain as if something had stung me.
Tell me why.
Because I don't want to give him the satisfaction, he said. If he knows how easily he can hurt me, what's going to make him stop?
His eyes darted back to my face, a glint of gray, imploring and apprehensive.
He'll give up if he doesn't think it's working, so promise me you're not going to say anything.
My guts clenched like someone had kicked me in the stomach. What I wanted to say was elusive, inapproachable, just out of reach. I grasped the nearest bedpost and leaned on it. My head was heavy with confusion, fury, and some other fierce thing I couldn't identify.
James, this is so fucked up.
I know.
What are we going to do?
Nothing. Not yet. Scene 3. During dress rehearsal the following night, I didn't take my eyes off Richard, but as it happened, when he went too far, I wasn't the only one watching. We had just finished Act 2, Scene 1, which included Brutus's conference with the conspirators, his conference with Portia, and his conference with Ligarius. How on earth James kept all of his lines straight, I had no idea. Wren and Philippa had exited stage right and were peering curiously around the curtain. James and Alexander and I had exited stage left and waited restlessly in the dense darkness of the wings for our next entrance. 3-1, the assassination scene.
How much time do you think I have?
Alexander asked, a hoarse whisper over his shoulder.
For a smoke?
I said.
Enough if you go now. If I'm late coming back, stall for me. How am I supposed to do that? Pretend you've forgotten a line or something.
And invoke the wrath of Gwendolyn? No. Wren put her finger to her lips on the opposite side of the stage, and James nudged Alexander with one elbow.
Stop talking. They can hear you on the other side. What scene is this?
Alexander asked in a lower voice. Richard had already entered, tieless and coatless, and was talking with a servant played by one of our inexhaustible second years.
Calpurnia,
I murmured. As if I had somehow summoned her, Meredith appeared between the two center columns, barefoot and wearing a short silk bathrobe, arms tightly folded. Alexander whistled under his breath.
Would you look at her legs? I guess that's one way to sell tickets.
You know, James said, for a boy who likes other boys, you provide a lot of heterosexual commentary.
Alexander,
I might make an exception for Meredith, but she'd have to be wearing that robe.
James,
you're disgusting.
Alexander,
I'm adaptable.
Me,
shut up. I want to hear this.
James and Alexander exchanged a look, which I didn't understand and chose to ignore.
What mean you, Caesar? Think you to walk forth?
Meredith asked when the servant had exited.
You shall not stir out of your house today.
She stood with one hand on her hip, expression dark and judgmental. The scene had changed since last I saw it. Meredith descended into the bowl, and as she described her dream, it sounded more like a threat than a warning. Richard, judging by the look on his face, was having none of it.
Well, Alexander said, I wouldn't count on him remaining at home.
The servant entered again, clearly terrified to even be on the same stage with the two of them.
Richard, what say the auguries?
Servant, they would not have you stir forth today. Plucking the entrails of an offering forth, they could not find a heart within the beast. Richard rounded on Meredith.
Richard, the gods do this in shame of cowardice.
Caesar should be a beast without a heart if he should stay at home today for fear. No, Caesar shall not.
He seized her shoulders and she twisted in his grip.
Is that the blocking?
I asked. Neither James nor Alexander answered.
Richard.
Danger knows full well that Caesar is more dangerous than he. We are two lions littered in one day, and I, the elder and more terrible.
Meredith squirmed and let out a cry of pain. Philippa caught my eye from the opposite wing and shook her head, just barely.
And Caesar, Richard bellowed, shall go forth.
He thrust Meredith away from him so roughly that she lost her balance and fell backward onto the stairs. She threw her arms out to catch herself, and there was a sharp crack as her elbow hit the wood. That same vindictive reflex I'd felt on Halloween made me lurch forward. To do what, I had no idea, but Alexander grabbed my shoulder and whispered, "Easy, tiger." Meredith pushed her hair out of her face and looked up at Richard with wide, angry eyes. The auditorium was silent except for the soft buzz of the lights for a split second before she said, "I'm sorry. What the fuck just happened?"
"Hold!"
Gwendolyn yelled from the back of the house, her voice shrill and distant. Meredith climbed to her feet and whacked Richard's chest with the back of her hand.
"What was that?"
"What was what?"
He, for some unfathomable reason, looked even angrier than she did.
"That wasn't the blocking!"
"Look, it's a big moment. I got caught up in it."
"And you decided to throw me on the fucking stairs?"
Gwendolyn was running down the center aisle, shouting,
"Stop! Stop this!"
Richard grabbed Meredith's arm and yanked her so close he could have kissed her.
"Are you really going to make a scene right now?" he said. "I wouldn't."
I bit back a curse word, knocked Alexander's hand off my shoulder, and ran out onto the stage with James right behind me. But Camillo got there first, jumping up out of the front row.
"Mo," he said, "break it up. Come on, calm down."
He wedged an arm between them and pried Meredith away from Richard.
"What's going on here?"
Gwendolyn said when she reached the edge of the stage.
"Well, Dick decided to improvise some blocking," Meredith said, pushing Camillo away.
She winced when his hand brushed her arm and her eyes flicked down. A drop of blood snaked out of her sleeve. My own vicarious outrage, overlapping and confused, half for James, half for Meredith, roared up in my chest, and I ground my teeth together, fighting a suicidal urge to tackle Richard into the orchestra pit.
"I'm bleeding,"
Meredith said, staring at the spots of red on her fingertips.
"You son of a bitch!"
She turned and flung the tab curtains back, ignoring Gwendolyn as she called,
"Meredith, wait!"
Richard's anger flickered off like a bad light bulb and left him looking uneasy.
"Everyone take 10,
Gwendolyn told the rest of us.
"Hell, take 15. We're having intermission now. Go!"
The second and third years were first to move, leaving the auditorium two by two, whispering to one another. I felt Alexander hovering behind me and took a bracing breath in.
"Camillo, would you make sure she's all right?"
Gwendolyn asked. He nodded and exited upstage. She turned to Richard.
"Go and apologize to that girl," she ordered, "and so help me God, don't pull anything else like that, or I'll have Oliver learn your lines, and you can watch from the front row on opening night."
"I'm sorry."
"Don't apologize to me," she said. But her ire was already fading to exasperation.
Richard nodded, almost humbly, and watched her make the slow walk back to the top of the house. Not until he turned around did he seem to realize that the other five of us were standing there glaring at him.
"Oh, relax," he said. "I didn't really hurt her. She's just angry."
Beside me, James had clenched his fists so hard his arms were quivering. I shifted my feet, too agitated to stand still. Alexander leaned forward just barely, like he was ready to throw himself between the two of us and Richard if he had to.
"For God's sake," Richard said when nobody replied. "You all know what a drama queen she is."
"Richard," Wren said.
He looked guilty, but only for a moment.
"Really," he said. "Do I have to apologize to all of you, too?"
"No, of course not," Philippa said in a calm, even voice that distracted me from the sound of my own pulse in my ears. "Why would you? You've only interrupted our run, fucked up Gwendolyn's blocking, forced Milo to break up a fight, possibly ruined a costume, maybe damaged the set, and injured one of our friends. Not for the first time, either. Now Oliver might have to learn all your lines and play your part and save the show when you inevitably fuck up again. And you have the balls to blame it on Meredith being a drama queen?" Her blue eyes were cold as frostbite. "You know, Rick, people aren't going to put up with your bullshit for much longer." She turned her back on him before he had time to respond and disappeared between the tabs. She'd said what we all wanted to say, and ever so slightly, the tension eased. I exhaled. James unclenched his fists.
"Just don't, Richard," Wren said when he opened his mouth again.
She shook her head with a tight, pinched expression not unlike disgust.
"Just don't."
And she followed Philippa. Richard sniffed, then said to me, James, and Alexander,
"Anything else?"
"No," Alexander said. "I think she pretty much covered it." He gave one warning look to me and James before he exited through the wings, already fumbling in his pockets for rolling papers. Only three of us left. James, Richard, me. Gunpowder, fire, fuse. Richard and James stared at each other for a moment, as if I wasn't there, but neither spoke. The silence between them was unstable, precarious. I waited, wondering which way it would tilt, the apprehension making all my muscles tighten under my skin. At last, James gave Richard the tiniest smile, a glimmer of petty triumph, then turned and followed Alexander out. Richard's eyes settled on me, and I thought they might burn right through me.
"Don't start learning my speeches yet," he said.
And he left me on stage alone. I was quiet, motionless. In my own estimation, pointless. A fuse with no fire and nothing to ignite.
Scene 4. When we finished our run, thankfully without further incident, I avoided the dressing rooms. I lurked in the lobby until I thought everyone else would have gone, then made my way back through the theater. The house lights had all been turned off, and I fumbled between the seats with numb hands, grunting at the armrests that reached out to smack my kneecaps in the dark. The crossover lights buzzed as I let myself into the men's dressing room, and I was relieved to find it empty. Mirrors on one wall showed me my own reflection, and a costume rack was pushed against the other, tightly packed with two or three suits for each of a dozen actors. The refuse of the theater was strewn on every surface, forgotten clothing, combs and hair gel, broken eyeliner pencils. I began to peel my costume off, for once without bumping elbows with four other boys. Normally I would have enjoyed the luxury of space, but I hadn't fully recovered from the second act disaster, and I was only vaguely relieved not to have to share the room with Richard. I hung my shirt, jacket, and pants carefully on one hanger, then stowed my shoes underneath the rack. My own clothes had been scattered around the room, likely picked up and discarded during the frenzy following Act 5, when everyone scrambled to get dressed and go home. I found my jeans crumpled in a corner, my shirt hanging off the mirror. One of my socks was hiding under the counter, but the other never surfaced. I fell heavily into a chair and had just finished pulling my shoes on, damn the sock, when the door creaked open.
"There you are,"
Meredith said.
"We didn't know where you went."
She was still wearing the robe. I risked one glance at her, then concentrated intensely on tying my shoes. "Just needed some room to breathe," I said. "I'm fine." I stood and moved toward the door, but she was in the way, leaning on the frame, one leg folded up like a flamingo, knee tucked perfectly in the curve of her instep. There was something introspective and uncertain in her expression, but her face was flushed, like the heat of anger hadn't quite left her. "Meredith, do you need something?
A distraction, maybe?"
She offered half a smile, waiting for me to catch on. Comprehension hit me with a little jolt, like an electric shock, and I leaned back, eased away from her. "I don't think that's a good idea."
"Why not?"
She seemed genuinely confused, almost impatient. I had to remind myself she was a natural actress.
"Because this is the sort of game where people get hurt," I said. "I don't particularly care about Richard just now, but I don't want to be one of them."
She blinked, and the impatience was gone, replaced by something softer, not so self-assured.
"I won't hurt you," she said.
She came cautiously closer, as if she were afraid of startling me. I was paralyzed, watching the silk move like water on her skin. A bruise was already swelling beneath her collarbone, and I couldn't help but think of Richard's hands and how much damage they could do.
"I can think of someone who might," I said. "I don't want to think about him."
Her voice had a raw, tender quality, which I didn't immediately recognize for what it was. Shame.
"Right, you want to be distracted." "Oliver, it's not like that."
"Really?
Then what is it like?"
It was a desperate question. I didn't know what it was meant to do, dissuade her or tempt her or challenge her, call her bluff, force her hand, make her show me. Perhaps all at once. The only thing it didn't do was dissuade her. She was still looking up at me, but in a way she'd never looked at me before, something reckless gleaming in her sea-glass eyes.
"It's like this."
I felt her hands on my chest, her palms warm through the thin fabric of my shirt. My heart stuttered at her touch, and I wondered suddenly if she was wearing anything under the robe. Part of me wanted to rip it off and find out, and another part wanted to crack her head against the wall and knock some sense into her. She leaned into me, and the press of her body overthrew all my logical objections. My hands moved automatically, without my permission, rising to find the curve of her waist, smoothing the silk against her skin. I could smell her perfume, sweet and lush and tantalizing, the fragrance of some exotic flower. Her fingers, softly insistent on the back of my neck, pulled my face toward hers. My pulse crescendoed in my ears, my imagination rushing treacherously forward. I turned my head abruptly, and the tip of my nose brushed her cheek. If I kissed her, what would follow? I didn't trust myself to stop.
"Meredith, why are you doing this?"
I couldn't look at her without staring at her mouth.
"I want to."
All my latent anger came bubbling up like acid.
"You want to," I said. "Why? Because James won't touch you and Alexander doesn't like girls? Because you want to make Richard furious and I'm the easiest way to do it?"
I pushed her back so we were no longer touching.
"You know what he's like when he's furious. You're lovely, but you're not worth that."
The last words were out of my mouth before I could catch them, before I even realized how awful they were. She stared at me for a moment, motionless. Then she turned and wrenched the door open.
"You know, I guess you're right," she said. people do get hurt. As the door swung shut behind her, I was transported back to our first day of Gwendolyn's class 2 months before. It was maddening how beautiful she was, but did that make the rest of her any less real? I dragged one hand across my face, feeling sick.
Hell,
I said quietly. It was all I could manage. I gathered my things, shouldered my bag, and left the building, furious by then at both of us. When I got back to the castle, I paused outside her door on my way up to the tower. One vagrant line of verse wandered through my head. Courage, man. The hurt cannot be much. I knew better than to believe it. Scene 5. The following morning, James dragged me out of bed a little after 7 to go for a run. The bruises on his arms had faded to a rotten green, but he wore a sweatshirt with the sleeves pulled down to his wrists. It was cold enough by then that it didn't look peculiar. We often ran the narrow trails that wound through the woods on the south side of the lake. The air was cool and sharp, the morning overcast, our breath coming out in long plumes of white. We kept a good pace together for a 2-mile loop, talking in short, stilted bursts.
"Where'd you go last night?" he asked. "I couldn't find you after final curtain."
"Didn't want to deal with Richard in close quarters, so I waited in the lobby."
"Did Meredith ambush you?"
I frowned at him.
"How did you know?" "I thought she might."
"Why?"
"Just the way she's been looking at you lately."
I stumbled over a root and fell a little bit behind him, then doubled my speed to catch up. "Me."
"How has she been looking at me?"
"James."
"Like she's a shark and you're an oblivious fur seal?"
"Me."
"Why is that the word everyone's using to describe me lately?"
"James."
"Who else called you a fur seal?"
"Me."
"Not that. Never mind."
I watched the ground for a moment, thinking. The dull ache in my left side intensified whenever I inhaled. The air smelled of earth and evergreen and approaching winter.
"So are you going to tell me what happened?"
James asked.
"What?" "With Meredith?"
He said it lightly, teasing, but there was apprehension there too. Guilt made my face warmer than exertion already had.
"Nothing happened," I said.
"Nothing?"
"Not really. I told her I wasn't interested in becoming Richard's next punching bag, and she left."
"Is that the only reason?" I could tell from his tone that he wasn't convinced.
"I mean, I don't know."
I'd lain awake most of the night repeating the scene in my head, agonizing over those last few words, thinking up 1,000 things I should have said instead, wishing it had gone a different way. I couldn't pretend I was immune to Meredith. I'd always admired her, but from what I thought was a safe distance. By coming closer, she'd confused me. I didn't believe she really wanted me, just that I was the easiest mark. But I couldn't admit that to James, because I was embarrassed, and because I was afraid I was wrong. He watched me, waiting for me to elaborate.
"It's like Alexander said the other day," I told him. "I couldn't decide if I wanted to kiss her or kill her."
We jogged on in an awkward silence, softened by the twittering of whatever dim-witted birds hadn't yet flown south for the winter. We passed the trail leading back to the castle and started up the steep hill toward the hall. When we were halfway up, I asked,
"What do you think?"
"About Meredith?"
"Yeah."
"You know how I feel about Meredith," he said, with a note of finality that discouraged further questions. But it wasn't really an answer. There was something unsaid, something trapped behind his teeth. I wanted to know what he was thinking, but didn't know how to ask. So we climbed the rest of the way up the hill without speaking. My calves were burning by the time we landed on the wide lawn behind the hall, doubled over, breathing hard. As our bodies cooled, the November chill crept in. My shirt was stuck to my back, beads of sweat sliding out of my hair and down my temples.
James's face and throat glistened feverish red, but the rest of his skin was pale from sleeplessness, and the contrast made him look distinctly unwell. "Water?" I said. "You don't look good." He nodded.
"Yeah."
We trudged across the wet grass to the refectory. At 8 a.m. on a Saturday, it was mostly empty. A few teachers and early risers sat reading quietly, mugs of coffee and breakfast plates in front of them. At one table, a cluster of dancers clad in black spandex stretched their long legs. At another, a choral music student sat inhaling steam from a cereal bowl filled with hot water, perhaps hoping to counteract the effects of what looked like a murderous hangover on her vocal cords. A small mixed group had accumulated at the far wall where the mailboxes were.
"What do you suppose that's about?" I asked.
James grimaced.
"I have a fairly good idea."
I followed him over, and the little crowd parted easily to let us through, maybe because we were flushed and sweaty, but maybe not. In the middle of the wall was a long corkboard reserved for general campus announcements. Usually it was thatched with club flyers and tutoring advertisements, but that day everything else was hidden behind an enormous campaign poster of Richard. He glared out at the viewer in monochrome red, his handsome features sharpened by deep black shadows. Below the immaculate knot of his tie, but above the smaller text detailing the production information, white block letters proclaimed, "Always I am Caesar." James and I stood staring at it for long enough that most of the other people who had come to investigate lost interest and wandered away.
"Well," he said, "that's bound to get people's attention."
I was still staring, annoyed that James wasn't more annoyed. "Fuck this," I said. "I don't want him watching me like Big Brother from every wall for the next 2 weeks."
"He doth bestride the narrow world like a colossus," James remarked. "And we petty men walk under his huge legs and peep about to find ourselves dishonorable graves."
"Fuck that also."
"You're starting to sound like Alexander."
"Sorry, but after last night, I think the odds of Richard ripping my head off went up like 100%.
"Keep that in mind next time Meredith throws herself at you."
"It wasn't quite like that," I said, and immediately wished I hadn't spoken.
"Be careful, Oliver," he said knowingly, as if he could read my mind. "You're much too trusting. She did this to me, too, first year. We were partners for voice class. That weird humming thing, remember?"
"Wait, she did what?"
"Decided she wanted me and assumed I wanted her because doesn't everyone? When I told her no, she changed her mind, acted like it never happened, and went after Richard instead."
"Are you serious?" He gave me a wry sort of look in reply.
"Jesus."
I glanced away around the refectory, curious what sort of secrets everyone else was keeping. How little we wondered about the inner lives of other people.
"Why didn't you tell me?" "It didn't seem important."
I thought of him twirling a strand of Wren's hair around his finger and asked, "Anything else I should know while we're on the subject?"
"No, honestly."
If he was hiding something, his expression, at ease, unaffected, didn't give it away. Maybe Alexander was right and James and I were equally oblivious. I shifted my weight. I felt like Richard was watching me, the poster a garish red blotch in my peripheral vision. I turned, sighed at it, and said, "I guess the good news is that after yesterday's drama, he'll have to stop trying to break your arms in Act 3.
"You think so?"
"You don't?" He shook his head in a sad, distracted way.
"He's too smart for that."
"So, what do you think he'll do?"
"He'll lay off, but just for the next few days. He'll wait for opening night. Gwendolyn's not going to run on stage and stop the show."
His eyes flicked back and forth across the poster. For a moment, he might have forgotten I was there. "James.
Now, in the names of all the gods at once, upon what meat does this our Caesar feed, that he has grown so great?
I was quiet for a while, then spoke one of my own lines in reply, unsure of where exactly it had come from. Me. Hold, my hand. Be factious for redress of all these griefs, and I will set this foot of mine as far as who goes farthest.
James's gray eyes sparkled gold as he looked back at me and said, "There's a bargain made."
There was something unfamiliar in his smile, some fierce gladness that made me at once eager and uneasy. I grinned back as best I could, then followed him to the kitchen to get a glass of water. My mouth was unbearably dry.
Scene 6. Richard's face haunted me for the rest of the week, but his wasn't the only one. Posters of James had also appeared, his done in royal blue, bearing the slogan, "Soul of Rome." Other publicity photos, featuring Alexander, Wren and Meredith, and then me, Colin, and our Lepidus together, appeared in the lobby of the Fab and the school newspaper. Campus began to hum again with anticipation for an upcoming production. On opening night, there wasn't a single empty seat in the house. Delacour's production quality was legendary, and the prospect of seeing the next big actor, artist, or virtuoso before fame snatched them away attracted more than the obvious collection of students and faculty. The house was packed with local Bartolators, students on field trips, and season ticket holders. In the spring, the best seats would be reserved for a troop of agents invited from New York to watch us perform. The lights came up on a group of excitable second years, the common Romans, giddy at the idea of being on stage at Delacour for the first time. The rest of us, more experienced and only half as agitated, waited in the wings. The play climbed through the first two acts until the tension was so great that the whole auditorium seemed to be holding its breath. The assassination was swift and violent, and as soon as James directed the conspirators to disperse, I stumbled off stage, ears ringing.
Fuck!
I blundered into the heavy black curtains on stage left. Someone caught me by the shoulders and guided me out of the tabs as the secondary conspirators shuffled past on their way back to the dressing rooms. The house rang with Antony's impassioned soliloquy over Caesar's body. Colin.
Oh, pardon me, thou bleeding piece of earth, that I am meek and gentle with these butchers. Thou art the ruins of the noblest man that ever lived in the tide of times. Woe to the hand that shed this costly blood.
I groped toward the wall in the dark, one hand over my ear. The same someone turned me around so I didn't fall face first into the fly lines.
Are you all right?
Alexander whispered.
What happened? He hit me right in the ear.
When? James's voice.
When I stabbed him. He turned around and smashed me with his elbow.
A bolt of pain so acute it felt solid had lodged in my skull like a railroad spike. I perched on the locking rail, leaning forward on my knees. A warm hand landed on the back of my neck. I didn't know whose.
That's not the blocking, Alexander said. Of course it fucking isn't, James said. Breathe, Oliver.
I unclenched my jaw and inhaled. James's hand slid to my shoulder.
Did he try to snap your wrists again? I asked.
Yeah.
He glanced toward the light slanting in between the downstage legs. Colin had finished his speech and was conversing with a servant.
Is he doing this shit on purpose? Alexander said. He about took my head off when I stabbed him, but I thought he'd just gotten carried away again. Have you seen James's arms?
James hushed me but unfastened his left cuff button and peeled his sleeve back. Even in the gloom of the wings, we could see blotches of blue and purple on his skin. Alexander let out a string of obscenities all in one breath. James shook his cuff back down.
Exactly. James, I said, we have to do something.
He turned,
the light from the stage turning his face a sickly, malarial yellow. It was nearly time for intermission.
All right, he said. But we leave Frederick and Gwendolyn out of it.
How?
There was a growl in Alexander's voice as he said,
If he wants a fight, let's give him a fight.
I tugged at my earlobe. A faint, shrill ringing pestered me like a fly.
Alexander, I said, that's suicide. I don't see why. He's bigger than all of us. No, Oliver, idiot. He's bigger than each of us.
He gave me a very pointed look. The lights on stage were suddenly doused, and the audience erupted into applause. All at once, people were rushing by. In the darkness, it was impossible to tell who was who, but we knew one of them must be Richard. Alexander pushed me and James both back against the line sets, and the heavy ropes wobbled and groaned behind us like a ship's rigging. His hand was a vice on my shoulder, the audience thundering in my ears.
Listen, he said. Richard can't fight off all three of us at once. Tomorrow, if he tries anything, instead of assassination, we give him a righteous ass-kicking.
Here is my hand, James said after a split second's hesitation.
The deed is worthy doing.
I hesitated also, a split second longer.
And so say I.
Alexander squeezed my arm. And I, and now we three have spoke it, let the stupid bastard do his worst. He let go of us abruptly as the house lights came up and the audience all rattled to their feet on the other side of the curtain. A few first-year technicians in black had already hurried on stage and were cleaning up the mess left after the assassination. The three of us shared a grim look and said nothing else, but went single file to the dressing room. I trailed after James, limbs tingling with the same restless feeling from the week before, both eager and uneasy.